Welcome to Demand, a game business podcast. My name is Chills, and with me is my co-host Raul, a business development specialist and game economist. Hello, Raul.
Hey, how you doing, Rob?
I'm doing very well, thank you. Excited to be here.
So what's on the docket for today?
Well, first we have an unlikely hit. The game is named Suzerain. What is the game Suzerain?
Suzerain takes the premise, heavy is the head that wears the crown. The setting is the 70s and 80s, kind of Middle East. It's a kind of thing where they've fictionalized the Middle East and Near East setting and tried to develop a comprehensive both visual novel and strategy simulation of what it would take to run a nation in this setting. And there is real-life equivalence. There is a Russia equivalent. There is a United States presence. There is several other things. I'm not going to directly name the country that I believe Suzerain is based on, but it's pretty head on the nail once you see some of the things and you're somewhat familiar with geopolitics and history.
Okay, so it sounds like it is a business or political simulation, but why would you say it stood out?
It has a very heavy, in-depth RP style storytelling method. While you do end up balancing forces and choosing your way through a very complicated political situation for the new head of Suzerain, it also tells a story of your family and the power players in and around Suzerain. And in that manner, it is an RP strategy mix, telling it in the manner of a visual story, very, very in-depth study. The listeners may not know right away, but I've worked in politics for on and off for decades as an economist and political manager of people. And this is close. This is very, very close to the real situation that happened. The depth is there, and the struggles, and there is no black and white. That's not a real thing anyway in the real world. So we basically get a very close look in and gamify what this situation would look like. And again, I stress it's like a 70s, 80s period of existence in Suzerain.
Okay, interesting. I have played the game, but it is interesting to hear your take, especially as someone that's worked in the real world economic and political space. One thing that I found interesting was, like you mentioned briefly, but if you could go into more about, there's multiple solutions to different problems. It doesn't shoehorn you into a particular worldview or political view.
The game is produced by a group called Topor Games, based out of Germany, and they certainly know their subject. Much like I harp on to clients privately and publicly, to others, I believe the craft matters in gaming, and it will always matter, because it is a creative endeavor, first and foremost. But the idea is not enough. The way you execute those ideas is everything, and in Suzerain, it's a beautiful presentation. It may not seem so attractive. It does not have glaring graphics that draw your eye. It does not have hot topics to hit upon. But the interesting idea is that it is hitting a mark that I named several people in the article version of this, including Horace Kamblin, Games, Devolver Digital, and many more, who Paradox itself, not the least of it, that they sort of are concentrating on the role-playing / strategy section. And Suzerain does it, and it does it in a way that is beautiful in and of itself, and it engrosses you, that very few games can draw you in to a world entirely, and Scissorine does it pretty well. Their craft is top notch in their presentation.
Agreed. The UI especially, I remember as being very well visually designed.
Oh yeah, the UI is super important, and here's a small shout out to all the UI folks that might be listening. Your job is vital. The way that they interact with the world is as important as anything else, visually or audible, or even narrative craft in the world itself. UI is your, or lack of UI, is your basic reason that players enjoy or do not enjoy the game. Typically, and it's their first measure, their first check mark, but many people seem to pass it by in the gaming business.
Agreed.
Or view it as secondary at best.
Often underappreciated, for sure.
Often. And specialists in this should be recognized for what they do.
100%. Okay, great. That's Suzerain.
By Topor Games.
And with that, we can move on to our main segment today, speaking on game economics. I am looking at the topic that you're presenting, taking sides.
Yes. Here's the idea here is that some people in gaming don't seem to like the idea of sides being presented. But if you look at most modern gaming of the last 20 years, there is a presentation of factions, Horde versus Alliance. Even in Overwatch, with the it's pretty nebulous, the teams, there is factions within Overwatch or anything else really that you see. One of the examples I use is Game of Thrones. Game of Thrones, while it's not a gaming product per se on its own, has factions within it. So does Warhammer 40K, and both Game of Thrones and Warhammer 40K as a property use these factions to tell the story, to involve the players, to get the players rooting. Why does this happen? This is an interesting idea. We are, by nature, whether it be nurture or nature, in fact, we are drawn to take sides. We are tribal people. Humans are human. Homo sapien is a tribal entity, and they will always identify, at least currently, with tribes. This has extended into football teams. Both world football and American football is a very good example. Why do people obsess over what is essentially a pair of colors and perhaps a name, naming a location, when there is nothing to gain or lose by following one or the other? But there seems to be a very big desire to do so. Gaming and creative peoples have long recognized this ideological identification. Well, there's two real main reasons, and one has to do with ideology. One is social identity theory. People derive self-esteem and a sense of belonging from the groups they derive from. I like synthwave music, and that puts me in a certain category to people that know what that is. I like dubstep. I like whatever. It really doesn't matter. The social identity theory means that because and we just passed this with the American elections, the Americans will understand this better than anybody. The political parties are nebulous, really, in identity. They change constantly. But for whatever reason, we side with one or the other, or at least more so. The gaming devs have long used this idea to get people more involved in the games that they produce. I just mentioned earlier Horde versus Alliance, and I'll talk about that for a little bit. Really, the games have always been balanced so that if they present sides, they are not overwhelmingly unbalanced. Maybe one side is better at one thing than another side, and then the third side could be something else. This is what happened in StarCraft, also by Blizzard. People began to identify with spacefaring races and factions that will never exist. and heavily for the Horde, for the Alliance, for this, for that. The Protoss, build more additional pylons is basically a call sign that you were the lead of an elite during StarCraft era days, because you were playing Protoss. Protoss was hard to play. They were very limited, and they got overwhelmed very quickly if you did not know what you were doing. Why does this differential affect us so much and have us play these disparate factions that will never exist? They're completely fantasy, but they do represent drives. A good example of this is 40K. The Imperium is basically a dystopia. However, you'll have people saying publicly stuff like skulls for the skull, which is a chaos thing, or they'll say the Emperor protects or something similar. And if you were to go to tabletop conventions like Gen Con or something like that, you see people arguing with each other in the hallways about whether the Emperor or the Chaos factions are really the winners or the losers or the good guys or the bad guys. And this is hilarious, but it does serve a purpose in gaming. It gets you to be able to, it gets you as the game dev and the narrative people to tell the stories you want to tell. What happens when one side is dominant over another side? What happens when a third faction interjects itself into what is a fractious conflict between the different sides within Warhammer 40K as they present it? Well, this is all very interesting. It allows you to tell stories and get people involved and take sides, which in turn involves them in your product. It is a method of immersion that I put forward. Game of Thrones does this as well. George R. R. Martin is a master storyteller, there's no doubt. But Game of Thrones is one of the most obvious examples. Each human house, has a human-based house, has a motto, has a strengths and weaknesses, and in fact, locations that they are traditionally associated with. This is an interesting idea. So you'll get people that were following the series that never had seen it before, that were just watching the HBO series for eight or so years, and they were like House Stark all the way. Or they would say Lannister is obviously the best faction, they're the most practical, because they see on the... Others would say stuff like, and each of them, each of these factionalizations of individual like fans, they would simply say the motto, which is a short, maybe three or four word statement about the thing. My favorite happens to be House Greyjoy. And the reason is that they are a Viking house for the most part, traditional Viking raiders in the Seven Kingdoms setting. Their motto is the most interesting to me because it states everything about them. It says, "We do not sow." When they mean this, they're not saying sow clothes, it's sow with an O, meaning you sow the land to become a farmer. Ironically, they don't sow. They simply raid everybody else constantly. You find out further in the books that people do not grow into adulthood until they pay the iron price. This is quite literal. They raid other areas, take their materials, which happens to a lot of times be iron or iron-based materials or items, and then bring it back to their leaders. Then they have become adults when they have contributed to their society by taking from others instead of becoming farmers or fishermen. They do not sow.
Those are good examples that you're citing, and I think you make some good points about how these factions in IPs and games bring people into a story. When I worked for Games Workshop, I saw this as well, and I also saw how the factions were used as a way to onboard new audience to the IP, which for something like Warhammer 40K or Game of Thrones, it can be overwhelming to a new audience member, but if you can find one of the factions that you identify with and you get into that, it kind of eases you into the greater setting and greater lore.
Certainly. A good example of how 40K does it on a larger scale is they usually will present new players with a very obvious alien enemy, Tyranids, which are like aliens from the series of movies called the Alien and Alien series. Or perhaps they really wanted to show you the Necrons, which are a technologically undead faction, kind of like skeletons that have are from time immemorial in the past. Then they present you with what is ostensibly the good guys, which is Space Marines, right? And Space Marines are great. They're few in number. They're basically our Spartan equivalent legend inside the game. Few elite, strong, powerful defenders of humanity, usually ideologically pretty decent. When you get in deeper, you find out some of the Space Marine chapters is how they're divided, are their own type of factions. But initially, that's how they usually present you. They do not present two good guy style factions against each other. They will present one faction that is, you know, if you like playing the villains, this is who you're going to play in their box sets for the tabletop. But the same is true. It same holds true in Warhammer 40K games on the video game realm. Typically, things like Dawn of War presented you with like three sides, typical kind of StarCraft or Command and Conquer style, right? And then you got more savage like the Space Orcs or like the Space Marines. And then you got a third faction, which was kind of weird, kind of like weird outsiders. And this is a very important way to, like you said, onboard people, because people can quickly identify, well, I like this style of play, or I like the style of aesthetics, so I will join as this. Game makers have long, for as long as there's been commercial gaming, video games, people have taken, I mentioned in the article itself, a much older game from 1983 called Archon. Archon is a chess-like game where you move the pieces, but then when they move into each other, you play a action-based combat. And both sides are completely different. One represents the good guys, the light, and one represents the bad guys. But the pieces are completely different, and they operate in different manners, both on the chessboard type simulation, and also in the physical conflict, the action conflict of the game. This is interesting because people, even at that time, on BBSs and things, they would argue over which one was better or worse, or which one actually represented the good guys or did not. This it has long been used by game designers as a method to draw people in and bring people into the worlds they create. The best known of this is, of course, the Warcraft world. It's a fantasy world. It could be called simplistic, but it's not really simplistic. It's easy to understand. There's only two sides, really, majority, and everybody is either on one side or the other, or perhaps a third faction when you find out through the MMO. There's other factions, and they are quite menacing. But they tend to be outsider factions that threaten both the established factions. And then, of course, there is no real difference within the game mechanically, because each does what the other does now, especially within the MMO. So it's not a big deal whether you choose one side or the other. It is flavors and whether you like the storyline belonging to one or the other. Again, this is a way for excellent storytelling and to draw players in. And like you said, onboard players. Some will prefer Alliance because it has more traditional fantasy races. Some will prefer the more savage and quote-unquote evil aspected races. And those will go to the Horde.
Those are good points. I like how you've mentioned the two or two of the benefits of using a faction in a game or a setting, and I hadn't really thought of these as being distinct from each other until this conversation, but how you can appeal to the player or the audience, their, how they identify. They might identify with being a space marine, you know, a noble crusading defender of humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And they also may identify with the play style, the mechanics of the game. Certainly. And now that you've mentioned this and I'm thinking it through, the most complex and interesting, I think, games and settings using factions can use one to subvert the other.
Oh, certainly. Certainly. And like, in fact, the longer a setting or an IP goes on, the more you'll find wrinkles and gray areas. This is partially by design, but any evolving IP cannot stay still. Star Wars is a great example, and this is more of an IP thing than it is a game business thing. But Star Wars had years where there was no movies, no TV shows, no nothing. So how did it survive, and how did it continue to grow fans? Well, it was now called the extended universe, right? Where through books and games and comic books, the world was explored. The setting, the world setting of Star Wars was explored heavily. What does it look like to be a gray Jedi? How does that work? Michael Stackpole made possibly the finest example in his Qur'an horn in I, Jedi. And that was when there was no TV series or anything like that. And further, what does it feel like to be a Mandalorian? Well, now we more than have that answer in the multiple TV series starring Mandalorians. You know, and the exploration and fulfillment of a setting for your IP also translates directly in how is it expressed. People will be big fans of certain parts of it. Some people don't even like the Jedi or the Sith. Of the Star Wars, they like the underworld, which is fascinating and broad and colorful. The reason we love Han so much, Han Solo, is because he touches on this world that is beneath the powers that are fighting for control, but they profit from both. That's fascinating. And that allows you to tell so many stories. The recent game Outlaws talks a lot about that. And Caesar, there is no... You know, I lift a planet with my mind moment in Outlaws, but there is a plenty of like, I'm going to screw this guy over because it's good for us, and we're the good guys, supposedly. You know, so there's lots of these type of moments, and the best way to employ it is not to prey on people's social identity or ideological differences, but it's to get them to see that there is more to the quote unquote opposing sides than there is separating the each other, right? And 40K, Game of Thrones, Star Wars, Star Trek is very good at that. They have over time developed these IPs that are mass and complex and very unique to each other, comparatively to each other. There is equivalence. There always is going to be equivalence because there's always going to be societies or cultures or organizations or factions that resemble each other, and they're always going to be a warrior society, a Mandalorians, a Klingons, or whatever. There's always going to be that, but how is it expressed in your setting? That's very important, and that draws people in for various reasons. And good game design can include that. What does it look like to have to flip sides in the middle of the story, in the middle of the gameplay? What if you had to play a Jedi to get to a certain point and then switch to a Sith character to finish the story? Fascinating ideas and gameplay possibilities just for that. You got used to being able to lift things with your mind? Well, stop that. Now you have to fork lightning people and, you know, and be very, very brutal, whereas before you were very kind and noble. The Sith taking over from a Jedi perspective, and how do you advance a storyline in that manner, and how do you create gameplay? This is all the this is what it's great for. And this and the best games take you on kind of a journey of this factional differences and navigating between several sides.
Agreed, actually. I really like that. I think when you reach a greater level of involvement on the part of your audience or your players, I think it then does go to what you're saying, where a good way forward is to subvert your own faction stereotypes.
Absolutely.
What if the Jedi player has to or could use a Sith power to achieve a goal?
Or tactic. What happens then? Interestingly, some of the favorite characters in the Star Wars setting have always done this. Like, it is pretty well known that Mace Windu, while being the council's hard ass in the movies, really flirted the line with what it was to be a Jedi, because he is more of a combat Jedi. And in his earlier sides, he displays it perfectly. He's one of the few Jedi masters to basically hold his own and was only killed as a betrayal.
Well, and you see this in the original series as well. In Return of the Jedi, Luke shows up at Jabba's palace wearing a black robe and force chokes the guard.
Yep, both guards, actually. They just, like, looked at him and they're gone. And he has no intention of leaving Jabba's palace with Jabba alive. He knows, because he grew up on that planet, he knows what Jabba and his people do. So he had no intention. There's no Jedi intention there. That was Sith-driven. I can almost say entirely.
It's a great injection of a little bit of, you know, countering the Jedi stereotype even there.
And of course, like all bad guys, he was dressing really good. So of course, you know, being evil in sci-fi fantasy speculation settings and games means that your dressing is on another level.
Oh, you have the best outfit for sure.
You have the best outfit in the series. It's bar none.
So we've got time for just maybe one more note here, but I wanted to ask, especially in gaming, you often see what we can think of as player factions, but you also will see non-player factions. Like in World of Warcraft, you have the goblins who kind of serve both sides, or enemy factions that attack both sides. What do you think their place is?
Two things. Player factions can be either like what Kissinger called real politic, and Eve will talk about this. We'll have a special show on MMOs and player and how they manage with guilds, whether they do well or not well. One of the things I'll cover is that Eve is the backstory. They're trying to elevate it now, but before, for many, many years, for decades actually, backstory didn't really matter. The player factions like Goonswarm and others really made up what the game was as you enter Nullsec, which is like their P versus P area, and where all the most delicious resources were, and people divided up the universe. What does it mean? How does Goonswarm operate, and how has it had to evolve? Them and others that control large swaths of the actual valuable territory. This is very interesting. How a person and a group leads a large conglomerate of allies is almost as interesting as anything the players can do, often more interesting because the player dynamics are more vast. Will this person be honest in their dealings? Will they betray at first light? In fact, speaking of Eve, one of the things that is known for is like deep moling into an organization to rob it completely for said other faction or corporation or whatever. And whether people do this or not while they're playing characters, these do represent time values that people have invested. So is it moral? Is it what we should expect? All of these things come up in player-made factions where they define what they do. And many MMOs and live service games have player-defined morality and ethics and goals. Some choose to be banks. I ran a bank completely. It was basically 30 to 40 people, but people with guilds with thousands of members were worried enough to create files on our organization. So really, these type of player factions can be as interesting and as vast as anything the players encounter in a game dev created setting.
Yeah, that's actually quite fascinating. My brother plays Eve. I haven't played it, but that all checks out. We'll definitely have to do a deeper dive into it down the line. But any final thoughts today?
I'd like to welcome everybody to the podcast. I hope it went well, that we didn't have disaster first podcast worries like many do. We will probably look back at this, Rob, and cringe, but mostly myself, since I'm the one talking the most. I'm scared, but it's fine. It's fine. Usually, I will tell the audience now, I rely on my sheer beauty to get me where I am today, which is nowhere. Take care, everyone, and have a great evening, and have a wonderful holidays.
You as well. Happy holidays to you and to our listeners, and we'll see you next time.
Take care. Bye.
Take care.